cigars and cooking for him, and ransacking the university libraries for ever more books which he could read aloud to him. No more Nietzsche, thank you, Sir Magnus. I think we know enough about the cleansing effect of violence. Kleist is not as bad, but you don't read him properly. You must bark Kleist. He was a Prussian officer, not an English hero. Get the painters. Which ones? Abstractionists. Decadents. Jews. Anyone who was entartet or forbidden. Give me a holiday from these mad writers. Pim consulted Frau Ollinger. Then you must ask the librarian for whomever the Nazis did not like Magnus, she explained in her governess voice. The librarian was an emigre who knew Axel's needs by heart. Pim brought Clay and Nolde, Kokotchka and Klimt, Kandinsky and Picasso. He stood their picture books and catalogues open on the mantelshelf, where Axel could see them without moving his head. He turned the pages and read the captions out loud. When women came, Axel again sent them away. I am being attended to. Wait till I am well. Pim brought Max Beckmann. He brought Steinlen, then Schiele, and more Schiele. Next day, the writers were reinstated. Pim fetched Brecht and Zuckmeier, Tucholsky and Remarque. He read them aloud, hours of them. Music, Axel commanded. Pim borrowed Herr Ollinger's wind-up gramophone and played him Mendelssohn and Tchaikovsky until Axel fell asleep. He woke, delirious, the sweat falling off him like raindrops, while he described a retreat through snow, with the blind hanging onto the lame and the blood freezing in the wounds. He talked of a hospital, two to a bed, and the dead lying on the floor. He asked for water. Pim fetched it, and Axel took the glass in both hands, shaking wildly. He lifted the glass till his hands froze. Then he lowered his head in jerks until his lips reached the brim. Then he sucked the water like an animal, spilling it while his fevered eyes kept guard. He drew up his legs and wetted himself, and sat shaking and grumpy in an armchair while Pim changed his sheets. Who are you afraid of? Pim asked again. There's no one here. It's just us. Then I must be afraid of you. What's that poodle in the corner? It's Herr Bastel, and he's a chow chow, not a poodle. I thought it was the devil. Till a day when Pim woke to find Axel standing fully dressed at his bedside. It is Goethe's birthday, and it's 4 in the afternoon, he announced in his military voice. We must go into town and listen to the idiot, Thomas Mann. But you're ill. Nobody who stands up is ill. Nobody marches who is ill. Dress. Was Mann on the forbidden list too? Pim asked, as he pulled on his clothes. He never made it. Why is he an idiot? Herr Ollinger supplied a raincoat that could have gone twice round Axel's body. Mr. San provided a broad black hat. Herr Ollinger drove them to the door in his broken car 2 hours early, and they took their places at the back before the great hall filled. When the lecture was over, Axel marched Pim backstage and hammered on the dressing room door. Pim had not cared for Thomas Mann till now. He found his prose perfumed and unwieldy, though he had tried his best for Axel's sake. But now there stood God himself, tall and angular, like Uncle Makepeace. This young English nobleman wishes to shake your hand, sir, Axel advised him with authority from underneath Mr. Sand's broad hat. Thomas Mann peered at Pim, then at Axel, so pale and ethereal from his fever. Thomas Mann frowned at the palm of his own right hand, as if asking himself whether it could take the strain of an aristocratic embrace. He held out his hand, and Pim shook it, waiting to feel Mann's genius flow into him, like one of those electric shocks you used to be able to buy at railway stations. Hold this knob, and let my energy revive you. Nothing happened, but Axel's enthusiasm was enough for both of them. You touched him, Sir Magnus. You are blessed. You are immortal. Within a week, they had saved enough cash to take themselves to Davos, to visit the shrine of man's diseased souls. They travelled in the lavatory, Pim standing and Axel, in his beret, sitting patiently on the seat. The conductor knocked on the door and yelled, Alle Billette, bitte! Axel gave a girlish whimper of discomfort and pushed their one ticket under the door. Pim waited, his eyes fixed on the shadows of the conductor's feet. He felt the conductor stoop. He heard him grunt as he straightened up. He heard a snap that felt like his own nerve breaking as the ticket reappeared under the door with a hole punched in it. The shadows moved on. "This is how you walked here," thought Pim with admiration as they silently shook hands. "These are the tricks that got you to Switzerland." In Davos that evening, Axel told Pim all about his nightmare journey from Karlsbad to Bern. Pim felt so proud and rich, he decided that Thomas Mann was the best writer in the world. "Dear Father," he wrote jubilantly as soon as he was back in the attic, "I am having a really wizard time here now, and getting some first-rate instruction. I cannot tell you how much I miss your worldly counsel, and how grateful I am for your wisdom in sending me to Switzerland for my studies. Today I met lawyers who really seem to know life in all its aspects, and I'm sure they will be a help in furthering my career. Dear Belinda, now that I have put my foot down, things are much better." Meanwhile, there was good old you, wasn't there, Jack? Jack, the other war hero. Jack, the other side of my head. I will describe to you who you were, because I don't expect we know the same person anymore. I will describe what you were to me, what I did for you, and as best I can, why. Because there again, I doubt whether we share the same interpretation of events and personalities. I doubt it very much. To Jack, Pim was just another baby Joe. One more addition to his private army in the making. Not broken, and certainly not trained, but with a halter already slipping nicely round his neck, and willing to run a long way for his lump of sugar. You probably don't remember, why should you, how you picked him up, or made your overtures to him. All you knew was, he was the type the firm liked, and so did you, and so did part of me. Short back and sides, speaks the King's English, decent linguist, good country public school, a games player, understands discipline. Not an arty chap, certainly not one of your over-intellectual types. Level-headed, one of us. Comfortably off, but not too grand. Father some sort of minor tycoon. How typical that you never bothered to check Rick out. And where else should you meet this paragon of tomorrow's men? But at the English church, where the flag of St. George fluttered victorious in the neutral Swiss breeze. How long you had been tracking Pim, I don't know. I'll bet you don't either. You liked the way he read the lesson, you said. So you must have had your eye on him from at least before Christmas, because it was an early Advent text. You seemed surprised when he told you he was studying at the university, so I guess your first inquiries were made before he enrolled there, and you hadn't topped them up. It was on Christmas Day, after Matins, that Pim shook your hand for the first time. The church porch was like a crowded lift, with everyone rattling umbrellas and making rah-rah English noises, and the diplomatic kids pelting each other with snowballs in the street. Pim was wearing his E. Weber jacket, and you, Jack, you were a tweedy, unscalable English mountain of 24. In terms of war and peace, the 7 years between us were a generation, more like two, much as they were with Axel, as a matter of fact. You both had those crucial years on me. Still do. Do you know what else you wore apart from your good brown suit? Your airborne tie, prancing silver-winged horses, and crowned Britannias on a maroon field. Congratulations. You never told me where you had been for it. But the reality, as I now know, is no less impressive than my imaginings. With the partisans in Yugoslavia, and the resistance in Czechoslovakia. Behind the lines with a long-range desert group in Africa, and even, if I remember right, in Crete. You were an inch taller than I, but I remember as if it were yesterday how, as Pim grasped your great dry hand, that airborne tie looked him in the eye. He lifted his head. He saw your rock jaw and your blue eyes, the ferocious bushy eyebrows even then, and he knew he was standing face to face with the character he was supposed to have become at all his schools. And sometimes in his fancy had. A straight-backed English brave of the officer class. The one who keeps his head when all about him are losing theirs. You wished him happy Christmas. And when you spoke your name, He thought you were making a sort of everyman's joke to do with Christmas Day. You are good fellowship, and I will be brotherhood. No, no, old boy, it's real, you insisted with a laugh. Why should a nice chap like me use a false name? Why indeed, when you had diplomatic cover? You invited him for a glass of sherry before lunch tomorrow, Boxing Day, and you said you would have sent him an invitation if you'd known his address, which was clever of you, because of course you knew it perfectly well. Address, date of birth, education, and all the other nonsense we imagine gives us ascendancy over those we seek to obtain. Then you did an amusing thing. You took an invitation card from your pocket, and in the crammed porch, while everyone went on woof-woofing, you spun Pym round, and, using his back to press on, wrote his name along the middle line and handed it to him. Captain and Mrs. Jack Brotherhood request the pleasure. You scratched out the RSVP to emphasize that the deal was done, and you scratched out the captain to show what pals we were. If you want to stay on afterwards, you can help us eat up the cold turkey. Rough clothes, you added. Pym watched you stride off through the rain, exactly as he knew you had carried yourself through the gunfire of all the battlefields, where you had triumphed single-handed over Jerry, while Pym was doing nothing braver than carve Sefton Boyd's initials on the wall of the staff lavatory. Next day he presented himself punctually at your little diplomatic house, and as he pressed the bell, he read your visiting card framed in the panel above it. Captain J. Brotherhood, Assistant Passport Officer, British Embassy, Bern. You were married to Felicity in those days, you may remember. Adrian was 6 months old. Pym played with him for hours in order to impress you, a habit that soon became a feature of his dealings with the younger members of your trade. You questioned him in a perfectly agreeable way, and where you left off, Felicity as the good Secret Service squaw took over, God forgive her. But what friends have you got, Magnus? You must be so lonely here, she cried. What do you do for fun, Magnus? And was there much in the way of an extracurricular life at the university? For instance, she asked, political groups and so forth. Or was it all a bit flat and dreary, like the rest of Bern? Pym didn't find Bern flat or dreary at all, but for Felicity he pretended he did. In the chronology, Pym's friendship with Axel was by now 12 hours old, but he didn't give him a thought. Why should he, when he was so taken up with impressing you both with himself? I remember asking what crowd you fought with, sir, expecting you to say 5th Airborne or Artists' Rifles, so that I could look suitably awed. Instead you went a bit gruff and said, General List. I now know that you were exercising the double standard of diplomatic cover. You wanted it to cover you, but you also wanted Pym to see through it. You wanted him to know you were an irregular, and not one of those intellectual little ponces from the Foreign Office, as you call them. You asked him whether he got around the country, and suggested that on occasions when you were making an official car journey somewhere, he might like to come aboard and amuse himself the other end. The two of us put on boots and went for what you called a bash, meaning a forced march through the Elfenauer woods. In the course of it, you told Pym he needn't call you sir. And when we came back, Felicity had fed Adrian, and there was an older, smirking man sitting talking to her. You introduced him as Sandy from the embassy, and Pym sensed you were colleagues, and vaguely that Sandy was your boss. I know now that he was your station head, and you were his number two, and that he was performing his standard task of looking over the property before allowing you to buy your way further in. But at the time, Pym just thought of Sandy as headmaster, and you as housemaster, a construction you would not have disapproved of.
How good's your German, by the way? Sandy asked Pym through his smirk, while the three of us munched Felicity's mince pies. Bit hard to learn here, isn't it, with all this Swissy dialect about?
Magnus knows rather a lot of university emigres, you explained for me, underlining a selling point. Sandy let out a silly laugh and slapped his knee.
Does he, though? I'll bet there's some rum characters among that crowd.
He could probably tell us a good deal about them, too, couldn't you, Magnus? You said.
You wouldn't mind, said Sandy, quizzically, still smoking.
Why should I?
Sandy forced the card cleverly. He sensed that Pym liked taking rash decisions in front of people, and he used this knowledge to press a commitment out of him before he knew what he was committing to.
No high-minded scruples about the sanctity of academic study or anything like that? Sandy insisted.
None at all, said Pym boldly.
Not if it's for my country.
And was rewarded by Felicity's smile. What version of himself Pym supplied that day, and had to live with for the coming months, I do not remember. Which means it must have been a fairly restrained one, short on those awkward story points that too often had to be paid for later. As best he could, he gave you what he thought you were looking for. He was prudent enough not to admit he was earning money, which went down well with you. For you knew already he was working black, as the Germans call it, meaning illegally and at night. Shrewd chap, you thought, resourceful, not above a bit of larceny. He played down family life with the Ollingers, since proxy parents undermined his self-image as a mature exile. When you asked him whether he knew any girls, the shadow of homosexuality, is he one of those? Pym got the message at once, and wove a harmless fantasy around an Italian beauty called Maria, whom he had met at the Cosmo Club and was keen on, but only as a stopgap for his regular girlfriend Jemima back in England. Jemima who? You asked. And Pym said, Sefton Boyd, which produced an audible sigh of social satisfaction. A real Maria did indeed exist, and was indeed beautiful, but Pym's adoration of her was private to himself, for he had never spoken to her.
Cosmo, said you. Don't think I've heard of that one. Have you, Sandy? Can't say I have, old boy. Sounds fishy to me.
Pym explained that the Cosmo was a sort of foreigner's political forum, and Maria was some sort of officer of it, like treasurer.
Any particular complexion? Sandy asked.
Well, she's dark, said Pym, ingenuously. And you and Felicity and Sandy laughed and laughed like little Audrey, and Felicity remarked that it was quite clear what Magnus's politics were. After that, no meeting was complete without somebody asking after Maria's complexion, and everyone cracking up over such a marvellously healthy misunderstanding. It was evening by the time Pym left your house, and you had given him a present of a duty-free bottle of scotch to keep out the cold. Cost to the firm in those days? I guess around 5 shillings. You offered to run him home, but he said he loved to walk, thus earning further brownie points. And walk he did, on air. He skipped and laughed and hugged his bottle and himself. He hadn't felt so blessed in all his 17 years. In a single Christmas, God had dished him up 2 saints. The one was on the run and couldn't walk. The other was a handsome English warlord who served sherry on Boxing Day and had never had a doubt in his life. Both admired him. Both loved his jokes and his voices. Both were clamouring to occupy the empty spaces of his heart. In return, he was giving to each man the character he seemed to be in search of. His decision to keep them secret from each other was never taken. Let each be the mistress that keeps the other home intact, Pym thought, if he thought at all.
From whom did you steal it, Sir Magnus?
Axel asked, in his formal English, looking curiously at the label.
The chaplain, said Pym, without a second's hesitation. He's a terrific bloke, ex-army.
I didn't steal it, he gave it me, actually. A free bottle for regular attenders. They get it at diplomatic rates, of course. They don't have to pay like in the shops.
He didn't offer you cigarettes as well, did he? Said Axel.
Why should he?
A bar of chocolate for a night with your sister?
I haven't got a sister.
Good. Then let's drink it.
Do you remember our car journeys, Jack? I begin to think you do. Have you ever wondered how our forebears managed to run their agents in the days before the motor car? Our first trip could not have come more handy. You had a date in Lausanne. You would need 3 hours. You gave no reason why you needed 3 hours in Lausanne, though you could have given me any cover story under the sun. Once again, with the advantage of hindsight, I know that you were deliberately admitting me to the secrecy of your work, without letting on what the work was. You asked nothing of Pym on that occasion. You were building intimacy. The most you did was give him a rendezvous and a fallback, and see whether he managed them.
Look here, it's just possible I'll have to make another call. If I'm not outside the Hotel Dora at 3, be at the west side of the main post office at 3:20. Pym wasn't good at East and West, but he asked about 6 people, till one of them got it right for him, and he made the fall back at 3:20 exactly, even if he was panting his heart out. You circled the square, and the second time round you kept the car rolling and pushed open the door, and Pym hopped in like an airborne soldier to show you how able he was. "I've been talking to Sandy," you said, as we drove to Geneva a week later. "He wants you to do a job for him, mind?" "Of course not." "You any good at translation?" "What sort?" "Can you keep your mouth shut?"
"I think so."
You gave him his first target for tonight.
"We get technical stuff in from time to time, mainly about funny little Swissy firms that are manufacturing things we don't much like. Nasty things that blow up," you added, with a smile. "It's not exactly secret, but we hire a lot of local labour in the embassy, so we'd rather have it done by someone outside, preferably a Brit, someone we trust. You game?"
"Of course."
"We pay. Not much, but it'll buy you a dinner with Maria now and then. Heard from Jemima recently?"
"Jem's fine, thanks." Pym had never been so scared in his life. You handed him the envelope. He put it in his pocket. You gave him your master of intrigue look and said, "Good luck, old chap."
"Yes, Jack, you did. We talked to each other like that."
And Pym walked home changing that damned envelope from one pocket to another so many times he must have looked like a bookie on the run. And what was in it?
Don't tell me. I'll tell you.
Junk. Photocopied junk from out-of-date armaments catalogues. It was Pym's soul you were after, not the piffling translation. He lost the envelope about 6 times in his attic, too. Under the bed, under the mattress, behind the mirror, up the chimney. He translated its contents in hours even Axel didn't know he had. You paid Pym 20 francs. The technical dictionary had cost 25. But he knew that gentlemen didn't mention things like that, even if Rick's checks, if they came at all, tended to meet with failure.
"Been to the Cosmo Club recently?" you inquired lightly as we headed towards Zurich, where you said you had a man to see about a dog.
Pym confessed he had not. With Axel and Jack Brotherhood as his cosmos, who needed another?
"I'm told some of the people who go along there are a bit outspoken. But nothing against Maria, mind. Those outfits always have a broad spectrum. Part of democracy. Might be a good idea all the same if you took a closer look," you said. "Don't stick out. If they expect you to be a lefty, let them think you are one. If they're looking for a right-of-centre Brit, give them one. If necessary, give them both. But don't go overboard. We don't want you getting into trouble with the Swissies. Any other Brits there, apart from you?"
"There are a couple of Scottish medical students, but they told me they come for the girls."
"A few names would help," you said.
With that one conversation, looking back, Pym was Pym no longer. He was our man in the Cosmo. Don't use the telephones for anything delicate. He was a symbolized agent, graded semi-conscious, which is our sweet way of saying he sort of half knows what he is sort of doing and sort of why. He was 17 years old, and if he needed you urgently, he was to ring Felicity and say his uncle was in town. If you needed him, you'd phone the Ollingers from a call box and say you were Mac from Birmingham passing through. Otherwise, it was meeting to meeting, which means we always fix the next one at this one. "Float, Magnus," you said. "Get in there and be your own charming self, Magnus. Keep your ears and eyes open, see what sticks. But for God's sake, don't get us into trouble with the Swissies. And here's your next month's alimony, Magnus. And Sandy sends his love."
I tell you, Jack, we reap as we sow, even if the harvest is 35 summers in the growing.
The secretary of the Cosmo was a vapid Romanian royalist called Anka, who wept unaccountably in lectures. She was gangly and wild and walked with her wrists turned inside out, and when Pym stopped her in the corridor, she scowled at him with red eyes and told him to go away because she had a headache. But Pym was on spy's business and brooked no rejection. "I'm thinking of starting a Cosmo newsletter," he announced. "I thought we might include a contribution from each group."
"The Cosmo don't got no groups. The Cosmo don't want no newsletter. You're stupid. Go away."
Pym pursued Anchor to the tiny office that was her lair. "All I need is a list of members," he said. "If I have a list of members, I can send out a circular and find out who is interested."
"Why don't you come to next meeting and ask them?"
Anchor said, sitting down and putting her head in her hands, as if she were about to be sick.
"Not everyone comes to meetings. I want to test all shades. It's more democratic."
"Nothing is democratic," said Anchor. "It's all illusion. He is an English,"
she explained to herself aloud, as she hauled open a drawer and began to pick through its chaotic contents.
"What does an English know about illusion?" she demanded of some private confessor. "He is mad."
She handed him a grimy sheet of names and addresses. Most of them, it turned out later, were misspelt.
"Dearest father," wrote Pym excitedly, "I am having one or two amazing successes here, despite my youth, and I gather the Swissies are considering offering me some kind of academic honour."
"I love you," he wrote to Belinda. "I've never written that to anyone before." It is night. It is Bairn's darkest winter. The city will never see day again. A smothering brown fog rolls down the wet cobble of the Herrengasse, and the good Swiss hurry dutifully through it like reservists headed for the front. But Pym and Jack Brotherhood sit snugly in a corner of their little restaurant, and Sandy has sent his extra special love, together with his absolutely warmest congratulations. It is the first time agent and controller have eaten together in public in their target city. An ingenious cover story has been agreed in the event of a chance encounter. Jack has appointed himself secretary of the embassy's Anglo-Swiss Christian Society, and wishes to attract elements of the university. What more natural than he should turn to Magnus, whom he knows from the English church? For deeper cover still, he has brought the lovely Wendy, who works in Chancery, and is honey-haired and well-born, and has a slight but prominent protrusion of the upper lip, as if she is permanently blowing out a candle just below her chin. Wendy loves both men equally. She is a natural and spontaneous toucher, with shallow, unfrightening breasts. When Pym has finished describing how he landed his great coup, Wendy cannot resist laying a hand along his cheek and saying,
"God, Magnus, that was so brave. I mean, marvellous. Wouldn't Jemima be proud if she was allowed to know? Don't you think so, Jack?"
But all very quietly, in the soft fall voice that even the horsiest must learn before they are let out of the paddock. And going very near to Jack, with her hair, to speak to him. "You did a damn good job," says Brotherhood, with his military smile. "Church should be proud of you," he adds, straight at his agent. They drink to Pym's good job for the church. It is coffee time, and Brotherhood has taken an envelope from one jacket pocket and from the other a pair of steel-framed half-moon spectacles, which give a mysteriously finite authority to his British brave face. Not alimony this time, for alimony comes in a white, unwatermarked envelope. Not a mousy brown one like this. He does not hand it to Pym, but opens it himself in full view of everyone who cares to watch, and asks Wendy for a pencil. "Dear, your flashy gold one. Don't tell me how you earned that." And Wendy says,
"For you, darling, anything,"
and drops it into his cupped hands, which close on hers. Jack spreads the paper out before him.
"Just want to check on a few of these addresses," he says. "Don't want to start sending out any literature till we're sure, okay?"
Okay, meaning, have you decoded this brilliant double entendre? Pym says absolutely fine, and Wendy trails a loving fingernail down the list, stopping at one or two lucky names that are marked with ticks and crosses.
"Only it seems that one or two members of our choir have been quite unduly modest about their personal particulars, almost as if they wanted to hide their lights under a bushel," says Brotherhood.
"I didn't really look," says Pym. Brotherhood's voice drops.
"Nor should you. That's our job."
"We couldn't find your lovely Maria anywhere," says Wendy, frightfully disappointed. "What have you done with her?"
"I'm afraid she's gone back to Italy," says Pym.
Not looking for a replacement, Magnus, are you, darling? Says Wendy. And all laugh uproariously, Pym loudest, though he would have given the rest of his life just for the sight of one of her breasts. Brotherhood mentions names that have no addresses. Pym can help with none of them, cannot put faces to them, cannot supply character descriptions. In other circumstances, he would gladly have made some up, but Brotherhood has an uncomfortable way of knowing answers before he asks questions, and Pym is getting wise to this. Wendy refills the men's glasses and keeps the dregs for herself. Brotherhood passes to addresses that have no names. A.H., he says carelessly. Ring a bell? A.H.? Pym confesses it does not. I really haven't been to enough meetings yet, he says apologetically. I've been having a rather hard slog at my work before exams. Brotherhood is still smiling, still perfectly relaxed. Does he know that Pym is sitting no exams? Pym notices that Wendy's pencil has nearly vanished inside his closed fist. Its sharp end peeks out of it like a tiny gun barrel. Think a bit, Brotherhood suggests, and says it again, mouthing it slowly like a password. A-H. Perhaps it's A-H somebody else, says Pym. A-H Smith, Schmidt. I could find a way of asking if you like. It's all quite open, really. Wendy has frozen in the way you freeze in party games when the music stops. Her smile has frozen with her. Wendy has the private secretary's art of suspending her personality until it is required, and something has told her it is not required at present. The waiter is clearing plates. Brotherhood's fist is covering the paper, so that quite by accident no names are visible to the passerby. Would it help if I told you that A.H., whoever he is, or she is, shares a certain address in Lengasse, or says he does, Kerevolinger? That's your place too, isn't it? Oh, you mean Axel, says Pym. Somewhere a cock was crowing, but Pym didn't hear it. His ears were full of a kind of waterfall. His heart was bursting with a sense of righteous duty. He was in Rick's dressing room, looking for a way of stealing back the love he had given to a wrong cause. He was in the staff lavatory, doing a knife job on the classiest boy in the school. There were the stories Axel had told him when he was delirious and spilling his drinking water with both hands. There were the stories he had told him in Davos when they went to visit Thomas Mann's sanatorium. There were the crumbs he had gleaned for himself on his occasional precautionary inspections of Axel's room. And there was Brotherhood's clever prompting that dragged things out of him he hadn't realized he knew. Axel's father had fought with the Telman Brigade in Spain, he said. He was an old-style social democrat, so he was lucky to die before the Nazis could arrest him. So he's a lefty. He's dead. I meant the son. Well, not really. Not that he said. He's just catching up on his education. He's uncommitted. Brotherhood pressed his eyebrows together and penciled Telman on his choir list. Axel's mother was Catholic, but his father had been a member of the anti-Catholic Los von Rom movement, which was Lutheran, Pym said. His mother lost her right to confession because she had married a Protestant. And a socialist, Brotherhood reminded Pym under his breath as he wrote. At the gymnasium, Axel's friends all wanted to fly planes against England. But Axel was persuaded by the visiting recruiting teams to volunteer for the army. He was posted to Russia, taken prisoner and escaped. But when the Allies invaded France, he was pulled out to fight in Normandy, where he was wounded in the spine and hip. Did he tell you how he escaped from the Russians? Brotherhood cut in. He said he walked. Like he walked to Switzerland, said Brotherhood with a hard smile. And Pym began to see a pattern that he had not thought of until Brotherhood suggested it. How long was he there? I don't know, but long enough to learn Russian anyway. He's got books in Cyrillic in his room. Back in Germany, he went ill from his wounds, but as soon as he was well enough to walk, he was sent to fight the Americans. He was wounded again and sent back to Karlsbad, where his mother was laid up with jaundice. So he put her on a cart with her possessions and pushed her to Dresden, a beautiful city which the Allies had recently bombed flat. He took his mother to the district where the Silesian refugees had gathered, but she died soon after he got her there, so he was alone. By now Pim's head was swimming. The colours on the wall behind Brotherhood's head were merging and sliding. "It's not me, it's me. I'm doing my duty for my country. Axel, help me."
"Righto, now it's peacetime, 45. What does he do?"
"Gets out of the Soviet zone."
"Why?"
"He was scared the Russians would find him and put him back in prison. He didn't like them, and he didn't like prison, and he didn't like the way the communists were taking over Eastern Germany."
"Good story so far. So what does he do about it?"
"He burns his pay book and buys another one."
"Where from?"
"A soldier he met in Karlsbad.
Somebody who came from Munich, who looked fairly like him. He said that in 1945, nobody in Germany looked like their photograph anyway."
"Why didn't this accommodating soldier want his papers?"
"He wanted to stay in the East."
"Why?"
"Axel didn't know."
"Bit thin, isn't it?"
"I suppose it is."
"On we go."
He boarded the repatriation train to Munich, and everything worked fine till he got to the other end, when the Americans pulled him straight off the train and put him into prison and beat him up.
"Why'd they do a thing like that?"
"It was because of his papers.
He'd bought the papers of a wanted man. He'd just walked completely into a trap."
"Unless, of course, they were his own papers in the first place, and he never bought them from anybody," Brotherhood suggested, writing again.
"Sorry, old boy, didn't mean to shatter your illusions. Way of the world, I'm afraid. How long did he do?"
"I don't know. He got ill again, and they put him into hospital, and he escaped from hospital."
"Pretty good at escaping, I must say. You say he walked here?"
"Well, walked and bummed rides on trains.
They had to shorten one of his legs. The Germans did. After he came back from Russia. That's why he limps."
"I should have said that earlier.
So I mean, even with trains, it was quite a walk. Munich to Austria, then Austria over the border at night to Switzerland, then to Ostermundingen."
"To where?"
"That's where Herr Ollinger has his factory."
Pim heard himself trying to make excuses.
"He hasn't any papers at all, you see. He destroyed his own in Karlsbad. The Americans kept the ones he bought, and he can't find anyone to give him a new set. Meanwhile, he's still on the Allied wanted list. He says he'd have confessed everything the Americans asked if only he'd known what he was supposed to have done wrong. But he didn't, so they went on beating him."
"Heard that one before, too," said Brotherhood under his breath, once more writing.
"How does he spend his days here, Magnus? Who are his buddies?"
Far, far too late, voices were whispering Pim caution.
"He's afraid to go out in case the Fremden Polizei arrest him. If he goes into town, he borrows a big hat. It isn't only the Fremden Polizei. If the ordinary Swissies knew about him, they'd inform against him too. He says they do that. It's a national sport. He says they do it out of envy and call it civic-mindedness. It's just household gossip, I'm telling you."
"Pity you didn't tell it to us earlier."
"It didn't mean anything. It wasn't anything you were interested in. Herr Ollinger told me most of it. He gossips all the time."
Brotherhood had his car outside. Man and boy were sitting in it, but Brotherhood didn't drive anywhere. Wendy had gone home.
Brotherhood asked about Axel's politics. Pim said Axel despised established attitudes. Brotherhood said,
"Describe."
He wasn't writing anymore, and his head was very still in the window frame. Pim said Axel had once remarked that pain was democratic.
"Reading habits?" said Brotherhood.
"Well, everything, really. Everything he's missed from the war. He types a lot, mostly at night."
"What does he type?"
"He says it's a book."
"What does he read?"
"Well, everything. Sometimes when he's ill, I get books out of the library for him."
"In your own name?"
"Yes."
"That's a bit rash. What do you get?"
"The whole spectrum."
"Describe?"
Pim described, and came inevitably to Marx and Engels and the Bad Bears, and Brotherhood wrote all of them down, asking him who Düring was when he was at home. Brotherhood asked about Axel's habits. Pim said he liked cigars and vodka, and sometimes kirsch. He didn't mention whiskey. Brotherhood asked about Axel's sex life. Sweeping aside his own limitations in this respect, Pym declared it mixed.
"Describe," said Brotherhood again.
Pym did his best, though he knew even less about Axel's sexuality than his own, except that whatever form it took, unlike Pym, he was on terms with it.
"He does sometimes have women," said Pym, deprecatingly, as if that was something all of us did.
"Usually she's some token beauty from the Cosmo, cooking for him or polishing his room. He calls them his martyrs."
I thought at first he meant martyr.
"Dearest father," Pym wrote that night, alone and miserable in his attic. "I am absolutely fine, and my head is buzzing from all the seminars and lectures, though I miss you as terribly as ever. One bad thing, however, is that I had a pal who recently let me down."
How Pym loved Axel in the weeks that followed. For a day or so, it was true, he would not go near him, he resented him so much. He resented everything about him, every move on the other side of the radiator. "He patronizes me. He sneers at my ignorance without respecting my strengths. He is an arrogant German of the worst sort, and Jack is right to keep his eye on him." Pym resented the mail he received. Herr Axel, care of Ollinger. He resented more than ever the Marthas, tiptoeing like shy disciples up the stairs to the great thinker's sanctum, and down again 2 hours later. He is dissolute. He is unnatural. He is turning their heads for them, exactly as he tried to turn mine. Diligently he kept a log of these developments to give to Brotherhood at their next meeting. He also spent a lot of time in the third-class buffet, wearing his clouded look, for the benefit of Elizabeth. But these exercises in separation did not endure, and the line to Axel grew tighter with every day. He discovered he could gauge his friend's mood from the tempo of his typing, whether he was excited or angry or tired. "He is reporting on us," he told himself, without conviction. "He is selling out the foreign students to his German paymaster. He is a Nazi war criminal turned communist spy in the image of his lefty father." "When do we ever get to read it?" Pym asked him, once, shyly, in the days when they were close. "If I ever finish it, and the publisher ever publishes it."
"Why can't I read it now?"
"Because you will take the cream off it for me, and leave me with the curds."
"What's it about?"
"Mysteries, Sir Magnus, and if they are spoken aloud, they will never be written down."
"He's writing his Wilhelm Meister autobiography," thought Pym indignantly. "That was my idea, not his." He could tell when Axel could not sleep by the striking of his matches as he lit his cigars. He could tell when his body was driving him mad. He told it by the altered rhythm of his movements and the determined gaiety of his singing as he clomped the wooden corridor to crouch for hours in their shared lavatory with its porcelain footprints. After several nights had passed that way, Pym was able to loathe Axel for his incontinence. Why doesn't he go back to hospital? "He sings German marching songs," he wrote to Brotherhood in his notebook. "Tonight he sang the whole Horst Wessel Lied in the lavatory." On the third night, long after Pym had gone to bed, his door suddenly flew open, and there stood Axel, wrapped in Herr Ollinger's dressing gown.
"Well, have you forgiven me yet?"
"What have I got to forgive you for?" Pym replied, discreetly pushing his secret logbook under the bedclothes. Axel stayed in the doorway. The dressing gown was ridiculously large for him. Sweat had made black fangs of his moustache.
"Give me some of your priest's whiskey," he said.
After that, Pym couldn't let Axel go until he had wiped the shadows of suspicion from his face. The weeks passed, and spring began, and Pym knew that nothing was happening, and that he had never betrayed Axel in the first place. Because if he had, they would have done something long ago. Occasionally, Brotherhood asked a couple of follow-up questions, but they had the ring of routine. Once he asked, "Can you tell me an evening when you know for certain he will be out?" But Pym was able to answer that there were no certainties in Axel's life.
"Well, look here, why don't you take him out to a slap-up dinner at our expense?" said Brotherhood.
One night, Pym tried. He told Axel he had had a windfall from his father, and wouldn't it be fun to put on disguise again, like the time they called on Thomas Mann? Axel shook his head, with a wisdom Pym dared not explore. After that, Pym studied and strove for Axel in every way he knew.
now denying to himself that brotherhood existed anywhere but in his mind, now congratulating himself on Axel's continued survival, which was owed entirely to Pym's nimble manipulation of irresistible forces. They came in the small hours of a spring morning, just when we fear them most, when we want to live the longest and are most afraid of dying. Soon, unless I make their journey unnecessary, they will come for me in the same way. If so, I trust I shall see the justice of it and relish the circularity of life. They had acquired a key to the front door and some method of detaching Herr Ollinger's chains, which were not unlike Miss Dubber's. They knew the house inside out because they had been watching it for months, photographing our visitors, sending in their bogus meter men and window cleaners, delaying the mail while they read it, and no doubt listening to Herr Ollinger's forlorn telephone conversations with his creditors and lame ducks. Pym knew there were three of them because he could count their stealthy Father Christmas footsteps on the squeaky top stair. They looked in the lavatory before they placed themselves outside Axel's door. Pym knew this because he heard the lavatory door squeak and stay open. He also heard a rattle as they removed the lavatory door key, in case their desperate criminal should attempt to lock himself inside. But Pym could do nothing personally, because at the time he lay deeply dreaming in all the scared beds of his childhood. He dreamt about Lipsy and her brother Aaron, and how he and Aaron together had pushed her off the rooftop at Mr. Grimble's school. He dreamt that an ambulance was waiting outside the house, like the one that called at the Glades for Dorothy, and that Herr Ollinger was trying to stop the men coming up the stairs, but was being ordered back to his quarters in a fury of Swiss dialect. He dreamt that he heard a shout of, "Pym, you bastard, where are you?" from the direction of Axel's room, and directly afterwards the awful, brief, thundering noise of a man with uneven legs struggling against three healthy intruders, and the furious opposition of Bastel, whom Axel had once accused of being his Faustian devil. But when he lifted his head from the pillow and listened to the real world, there was silence, and everything was absolutely fine. I held it against you, Jack, I confess. I argued with you in my head for years, uphill, downhill, and long after I had joined the firm. Why had you done it to him? He wasn't English. He wasn't a communist. He wasn't the war criminal the Americans claimed he was. He was nothing to do with you. His only crimes were his poverty, his illegal presence, and his lameness, plus a certain freedom in his way of thinking, which, in the eyes of some, is what we are there to protect. But I did nurse a grudge, and I'm sorry. Because now, of course, I know you hardly gave it a thought. Axel was another bit of barter material. You wrote him up. He came back into your in-tray, looking formidable and sinister in Wendy's flawless type. You lit your pipe and admired your handiwork, and you thought, "Hello, I'll bet the old Swissies will like a smell of this one. I'll pop it down to them and earn myself a brownie point." You made a phone call or two and invited some contact in the Swiss Security Service to join you for an extended luncheon at your favourite restaurant. Over the coffee and the schnapps, you slipped him an anonymous brown envelope. As an afterthought, you slipped a copy to your American colleague, too, because if you're going to earn one favour, why not earn a second while you're about it? After all, it was the Yanks who put him in the cooler, even if they got his record wrong. You were junior then, too, weren't you? You had your way to make, as we all have. Maturer now, both of us. Sorry to be so lengthy in the remembering, but the episode took me rather a long time to forget. I've got it straight now. Served me right for having a friend outside the service.
Mr. Canterbury, you've got a man.
Pym had put down his pen. He had not looked towards the door. Almost before he was aware of it, he had leapt to his slippered feet and was flying across the room to where the metal-lined black briefcase, still locked, stood against the wall. Dropping to a crouch beside it, he inserted the complicated key in the first lock and sprung it. Then the second. Anti-clockwise, or it fires. "What man's that, Miss D?" he said in his softest and most reassuring tone, one hand already in the case.
"With a cabinet, Mr. Canterbury,"
Miss Dubber replied, with disapproval through the keyhole.
"You've never had a cabinet before. You've never had anything. You've never locked your door either. What's wrong?
Pym laughed. Nothing's wrong. It's just a cabinet. I ordered it. How many of them are there?
Taking the briefcase with him, he tiptoed to the window and squared his back against the wall, while he squinted cautiously through the gap in the curtain.
Just one, isn't that enough? A great green ugly one made of iron. If you'd wanted a cabinet, why didn't you tell me? You could have had Mrs. Tutton's cupboard from room two.
I meant how many men?
It was daylight. A yellow taxi truck was parked outside the house, the driver at the wheel. He glanced round the rest of the square, fast, checking everything. Then slowly, checking everything again.
What does it matter how many men, Mr. Canterbury? Why do we have to count the men when it's a cabinet?
Relaxing, Pym replaced the briefcase in its corner and relocked it. Clockwise, or it fires. He returned the keys to his pocket. He opened the door.
Sorry, Miss D, I think I must have been dozing.
She watched him down the stairs, then went after him and watched again as he looked first at the two men, then shyly at the green cabinet, lightly touching its chipped paintwork up and down, tugging at each drawer in turn.
It's a bloody weight, Governor, I'll tell you, said the first.
Who's it got in it, then?
Said the second. She watched him lead the men up to his room, the cabinet between them, and lead them down again. She watched him pay their bill in cash from his back pocket, and give them an extra £5 for themselves.
Sorry about that, Miss D, he said, as they drove off.
Some old ministry archives I'm working on. Here, this is for you.
He handed her a travel brochure he had brought down with him from his room. There was a whiff of rick about the capitals. Discover Tunisia in the luxury of our air-conditioned coach. Seniors a speciality. Shades of the East in the Mediterranean. Enough to make your mouth water.
But Miss Dibber would not accept the brochure.
Toby and I aren't going anywhere any more, Mr. Canterbury, she said. Whatever's troubling you won't go away with us, that's for sure.
Chapter 9. Brotherhood had bathed, and shaved, and cut himself, and put on a suit. He had listened to the news on the BBC, and afterwards tuned to the Deutsche Welle, because sometimes the foreign press got hold of stories while Fleet Street was still obediently suppressing them. But he had heard no light-hearted mention of a senior officer of the British Secret Service going walkabout, or turning up in Moscow. He had eaten a piece of toast and marmalade. He had made a few phone calls. But 6 till 8 of an English morning were the dead hours, when nobody except himself was about. On a normal day, he would have walked across the park to head office, and given himself a couple of hours at his desk, reading the night's crop of station reports, and preparing himself for the 10 o'clock prayer session in Bowes Sanctum.
"So how's our Eastern Front this rainy morning, Jack?"
Beau would say, in a tone of jokey veneration, when Brotherhood's turn came round. And a respectful quiet would follow, while the great Jack Brotherhood gave his chief the score.
"Some quite nice stuff from Conga on the Comic-Con trading figures for last year, Beau. We've sent it up to Treasury by special bag. Otherwise it's the silly season. Joes are on holiday. So's the opposition."
But this was not a normal day, and Brotherhood was no longer the grand old man of covert operations that Beau cracked him up to be when he introduced him to visiting firemen from Western Liaison Services. He was the latest unperson in the latest looming scandal, and as he stepped into the street below his flat, his quick gaze was more than usually vigilant. It was 8:30. First he headed south across Green Park, walking as fast as ever, and perhaps a little faster, so that Nigel's watchers, if they were on him, would either have to gallop or radio for somebody to get ahead of him. The night's rain had stopped. Warm, unhealthy mist hung over the ponds and willows. Reaching the Mall, he hailed a cab and told the driver Tottenham Court Road. He walked again and took a second cab to Kentish Town. His destination was a grey hillside of Victorian villas. The lower reaches were still run down, their windows plugged with corrugated iron against squatters. But higher up, Volvo estate cars and teak-framed dormer windows testified to the safe arrival of the middle classes, and the long gardens boasted coloured climbing frames and half-made dinghies.
Here, Brotherhood was no longer in a hurry. He trudged up the hill slowly, noting everything at his leisure. This is the pace I have earned in life. This is the smile. A pretty girl passed him on her way to work, and he greeted her indulgently. She winked pertly back at him, proving for all time that she was not a watcher. At number 18 he paused, and in the manner of a prospective purchaser, stood back and surveyed the house. Bach and a smell of breakfast issued from the ground-floor kitchen. A wooden arrow marked 18A pointed down the basement steps. A man's bicycle was chained against the railings. A poster for the Social Democratic Party hung in the bay window. He pressed the bell. A girl in a blazer opened the door to him. At 13, she already wore an air of superiority. "I'll get Mummy," she said before he could speak, and turned sharply so that he could watch her skirt swing. "Mummy, it's a man. For you," she said, and sweeping past him down the steps, set off for her decent school. "Hello, Belinda," Brotherhood said. "It's me." Coming out of the kitchen, Belinda paused at the foot of the stairs, drew a breath and yelled up them at a closed door. "Paul, come down at once, please. Jack Brotherhood is here. I assume he wants something." Which is more or less what he knew she'd shout, though not quite so loud, because Belinda had always reacted badly first and put it right rather sweetly later. They sat in a pine drawing room on low basketwork chairs that creaked like swings when you moved. A gigantic lampshade of white paper rocked crookedly above them. Belinda had made coffee in hand-thrown mugs and sweetened it with natural sugar. Her Bach still played defiantly in the kitchen. She was dark-eyed and angry about something in her childhood. At 50, her face was still set ready for another quarrel with her mother. She had graying hair, bound in a sensible bun, and wore a necklace of what looked like nutmeg. When she walked, she waded through her caftan as if she hated it. When she sat, she spread her knees and scraped at the knuckles of one hand. Yet her beauty clung to her like an identity she was trying to deny, and her plainness kept slipping like a bad disguise. "They've already been here in case you don't know, Jack," she said. "At 10 at night, as a matter of fact. They were waiting for us on the doorstep when we got back from the cottage." "Who's they?" "Nigel, Lorimer. Two more I didn't know. All men, of course." "What did they say they were here for?" Brotherhood asked. But Paul stopped him. You could never be angry with Paul. He smiled so wisely through his pipe smoke, even when he was being rude. "What is this actually, Jack?" he said, taking his pipe from his mouth and lowering it until it became a hand microphone. "Interrogations about interrogations. You people have no constitutional position, you know, Jack. You're only a chartered body, even under this government, I'm afraid. You probably don't know it, but Paul has written extensively on the rise and rise of the paramilitary services under the Tories," Belinda said, in a voice that struggled to be harsh. "You'd know if you'd bother to read The Guardian, but you don't. They gave him a whole page for the last one." "So screw you, actually, Jack," said Paul, just as pleasantly. Brotherhood smiled. Paul smiled. An old English sheepdog wandered in and settled at Brotherhood's feet. "Do you want to smoke, by the way?" said Paul, ever sensitive to people's needs. "I'm afraid Belinda draws the line at fags, but I can offer you a nifty little brown one if you're pushed." Brotherhood pulled out a packet of his foul cigarettes and lit one. "Screw you too, Paul," he said equably. Paul had peaked early in life. 20 years ago he had written promising plays for fringe theatres. He wrote them still. He was tall but reassuringly unathletic. Twice, to Brotherhood's knowledge, he had applied to join the firm. Each time he had been turned down flat, even without Brotherhood's intervention. "They came here because they're vetting Magnus for a top appointment, if you want to know," Belinda said, all in one breath. "They were here in a hurry because they wanted to promote him immediately, so that he could get on with the job."
"Nigel!" Brotherhood echoed, with an incredulous laugh. "Nigel and Lorimer, plus two other men, doing their own vetting at 10 o'clock at night. You've got half the brass of secret Whitehall on your doorstep there, Bell,